Synesthesia is what it is, but what you do with your synesthesia is kind of down to you, and you can use synesthesia as a tool.
The prevalence of autism is 1% in the population. Synesthesia is estimated to be 4%. How reliable are those numbers?
My guess is that the brains of synesthetes are different from very early on, you know, maybe from infancy. Things that we do actually find, to bring the conversation back to autism, is that the more types of synesthesia you have, the further along the autism spectrum you are. So there are a number of studies that take people with a clinical diagnosis of autism, and then they look for the presence of synesthesia. Migraine is, again, linked to sensory sensitivity. So I think that that is one of the unanswered questions that we still have dangling.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back to Let's Talk Synesthesia. I'm Maike, your host. I'm just giving you a quick introduction before we dive into the episode, because I wanted to give you a heads up and a couple of informations. One is that the audio quality on my side wasn't the best this time, and I'm so sorry for that. That's really annoying, and I know that it's not the most comfortable to listen to podcasts when the audio quality isn't on point. I make sure I figure it out by next time. Luckily, we hear Professor Jamie Ward, our guest for today, for the majority of the time, so it should be fine listening. That being said, I have a couple announcements for you. The podcast is turning one, and I am so stoked to announce that I am, for this occasion, am collaborating with the international nonprofit organization Journey Through the Senses. Anton and James, both guests that were on the podcast before, are part of Journey Through the Senses, and I'm so thrilled that they are supporting the event, and I think it will be fantastic. So I know a lot of you are not based in Europe, so I'm not going to talk about it for ages, just a couple quick infos so you can figure out if you want to join, because spots are very limited in the venue. We're going to watch a screening of the play The Possibility of Color by Pete Carruthers, who was also on the podcast before. Maybe you remember the episode because a person read out the plot of the story at the beginning, and then Pete and I had a conversation about what is normal, who gets to decide, what are diagnoses, how do they help us, how do they hinder us. The play is a story about people with different neurodivergent conditions, so it's just perfect for the purpose of this event. We're going to watch it. Pete and James Warnerton are going to fly from the UK to Innsbruck, Austria to join the event and the Q&A. We're going to have a panel afterwards. There will be snacks and goodie bags, and we're going to go for drinks and dinner afterwards. If you want to join, please leave me an email or a message on Instagram. The other thing is that my group sessions for synesthetes have started, and the first one, which was actually about autism and synesthesia, is already in the past, and feedback was really, really good, and I was so excited that people joined and liked it and benefited from it. But there are 5 more to go, so if you want to join any of those, I'm so keen to have you, to meet you there. The sessions are meant for you to exchange your unique experiences with your neurodivergence and especially your synesthesia with people who actually really get it, which is just not very common in our day to day. So please find the link on Instagram or in the show notes or on my website to book your slots. All right, so today we're going to get a good overview over autism and synesthesia, and what do we know and what do we not know yet about its intersection from a cognitive neuroscience perspective. If you want to learn more about the psychological experience, I'm currently conducting interviews about the intersection of mental health and synesthesia, where autism plays a big role, and I'm going to write at least an ebook or maybe a more extended version about that. If you want to give your expertise, please reach out over my website. And if you just want to be up to date about whatever resource I put out there, make sure to connect with me somewhere so you can get all of that. Okay, let's see what Professor Jamie Ward has to tell us. Enjoy.
We're going to talk about autism and synesthesia. And my very special guest today is Professor Jamie Ward, Professor for Cognitive Neuroscience from the University in Sussex in England. Hi, Jamie. Thank you so much for being back on the podcast.
You're welcome. Yeah, it's a pleasure to join you.
we're going to talk about how autism and synesthesia is connected, what do we know from a neuroscientific perspective. Maybe we will also touch on what having both autism and synesthesia looks like in my psychological practice, because, you know, those traits really can cause a lot of extra information in your brain that really disrupts our lives. I also got a couple of questions from listeners and people on Instagram. And one of the biggest questions, I think, is synesthesia connected with other neurodivergent conditions as well, like epilepsy, ADHD? So maybe if we have time, we'll touch on that in the end. So how about we just start by asking you to give a brief introduction into what is autism and what is synesthesia from a research perspective?
Mm-hmm. So autism is traditionally defined in terms of problems in social understanding and social communication. Over the years, people have become more aware of the fact that autism encompasses sensory and attentional symptoms. So some of the sensory symptoms might be feeling overwhelmed by sights and sounds. And some of the attentional symptoms are actually positive things rather than symptoms in the traditional clinical sense. So it might be noticing things that other people don't notice, or an interest in patterns, or maybe an aptitude in detecting patterns that other people miss. So autism is this broad spectrum. People often think about the spectrum of autism in terms of less severe to most severe, and that's certainly one way of thinking about it. But if you imagine autism as being a collection of multiple traits, so sensory, attention, social communication, you could be more or less severe on any of those. So actually you could think of it as perhaps being multidimensional rather than a single spectrum. You can have multiple spectrums, though. You might be at the end point of all of them, or you might be high on one and low on another. And that's one of the things that science doesn't really have a good handle on at the moment, because it's been dominated by clinical categories, and categories kind of want you to draw hard boundaries. People with synesthesia experience the ordinary world in extraordinary ways. So when they're listening to music, music might not just be an auditory thing that you hear. It might be a visual thing that you see, dancing flickers and blobs and shapes and textures that come and go as the music changes. So it's a multi-sensory experience that people with synesthesia are having when they perhaps think of numbers or listen to music or hear somebody speaking. Maybe they taste words. So on the face of it, these are two different profiles of symptoms. So I've been researching synesthesia for many, many years, and people would often ask me whether I thought there was a connection between synesthesia and autism. And my answer was always no, because it seems that the core symptoms or the core features of these things are just quite different. There are other differences as well. So we know that autism is more common in men. Part of it's an underdiagnosis thing, but I think most people realize it genuinely is more common in men. Synesthesia, that's not the case. It's equally common in men and women. So there are these other differences that imply that they're not going to be one and the same. But actually, there is convincing evidence that they are connected. And I think the puzzle for us is to understand how and why that connection occurs. So the evidence comes from multiple directions. So there are a number of studies that take people with a clinical diagnosis of autism, and then they look for the presence of synesthesia within those groups. So depending on the types of synesthesia we're talking about, something like colored letters and numbers is 1 to 2% of the population. And you can show that this is more common, 3-4 times as common, perhaps more in people with autism. So it's still rare within autism, but it's a much higher trend. And you can also look at it the other way around. So you can take people with synesthesia who've passed a test of synesthesia. So we really believe that these people have synesthesia. And then you can look for autistic traits in them. And you can do this by simply asking them, have you got a diagnosis of autism? Or you can give them questionnaires. And a questionnaire might then assess the full spectrum. So some people might be high on the autism spectrum without a diagnosis. And these kinds of questionnaires can get at that. And we find evidence for this as well. So you can either take people with autism and look for synesthesia. You can take people with synesthesia and look for autism. And depending on which direction you come in, you get to the same answer, that there is that these things co-occur. And actually, they also co-occur within families. So we've looked at this. For example, we might have a mother with synesthesia who doesn't have autism, but then she has an autistic child and a synesthetic child, and then a child with autism and synesthesia. So it's almost as if a synesthetic mother is more likely to give birth to an autistic child with or without synesthesia. So it's almost as if the same gene pool can produce these very different or superficially different phenotypes, which is just patterns of traits. That's all I mean by phenotype.
But do we know anything about why that is? Like, when we look at the brain, if in a brain scan, is there anything that we can pinpoint why that higher prevalence is the case?
In terms of the brain, we don't actually have much of an understanding in terms of what the similar profile is. There's lots of research looking at the brains in autistic people. One of the challenges here is the diversity amongst the autism community, and that there might not be a brain type of autism, which isn't to say that it is not coming from the brain. It's just that they might have different features of the brain might be different in one individual and another. So we might be able to talk about an average autistic brain, but actually the average autistic brain might be completely different in person A and person B. And by averaging them together, you get something, but it's not necessarily the true picture. And we've kind of got the same problem with synesthesia. So one of the things we've just done at Sussex is that we've collected 102 detailed MRI scans of people with synesthesia. And what we then want to do is take known biomarkers for autism and apply it to the synesthesia sample. So that's one of the things where we have a data set that we can start to answer these sorts of questions. There are a few things where they simply just don't match. So in autism, and this applies particularly to males with autism, there's a chance that they will have larger heads. And this is because they have accelerated brain growth in childhood. Synesthetes have smaller heads and normal sized brains. So it's exactly the opposite profile. So even just something very simple about head growth, your head grows to the size of your brain when you're a child, and then your skull fuses and it becomes fixed. So the size of your head reflects what was happening to the size of your brain when you were a child of age 4 or 5. But we show different profiles here. So synesthetes have on average smaller heads, and people with autism on average have larger heads. So they are not mapping onto each other in a simple way. Where we do have a sense of where the connections might be is that if we look at the full symptom profile of autism, what we find is that people with synesthesia tend to strongly have the sensory and attention-based features of autism. So that includes sensory sensitivity, finding sounds, light, smells aversive or overwhelming, or being overreactive to them, and also good kind of attentional skills in the sense of being able to spot patterns, being able to do Where's Wally, Where's Waldo puzzles. Synesthetes are good at that, and people with autism are good at that. People with synesthesia do have some of the kind of classic social communicative problems with autism, but not necessarily to the same degree as the sensory or attention ones. So we can start to see that actually, although we can say that there is a link between synesthesia and autism, it might be driven by some features of autism more than others.
We still have to acknowledge that we just don't know enough about the brain yet, right? To understand how these very complex conditions that look so different in everybody, how they actually manifest in the brain. And it's very difficult to pinpoint.
Yeah, we can see that there is definitely an overlap between synesthesia and autism, and we can see that it's stronger for some symptoms more than others. What we can't see is a common kind of brain basis for either of these symptoms or for autism and synesthesia. But that's not that we've spent, you know, decades trying. We really haven't. This is kind of off the press, kind of ongoing research that people are only starting to really look at. So we will get there.
Amazing. Well, I can't wait. The aspect of being very sensory sensitive as an autistic person was quite overlooked, right? Like, it was more focused on the communication difficulties. And then this whole, you know, movement of highly sensitive people, HSP, developed.
I can understand where you're coming from. I mean, I suppose you could say that if you're highly sensitive, it's not a skill in the same way as being able to understand what other people are thinking. You could say that that is a skill. So, you know, that did lead people into this kind of more deficit model of autism. Actually, it's a difference. You know, people with autism have other skills, as I've said. Whereas being sensitive is... For somebody who is highly sensitive, it's not necessarily a desirable thing. I suppose from a kind of a social perspective, it's neither good nor bad necessarily. I mean, it might mean that you avoid certain things. It might mean that you notice other things. It's not clear how we kind of put a judgment value on whether that's a good or bad thing to have. Certainly for people who have it, it's often something that they do want to be able to manage. Obviously, people don't want to be cured of their autism, but they do want to be able to interact with non-autistic people, and they want to be able to manage certain symptoms. And the sensory sensitivity is one of the things that comes out as being something that they want to manage themselves. But of course, other people don't necessarily see their sensory sensitivity. They just see that perhaps they're showing avoidant behavior or something like that. You know, sensory sensitivity is a very private experience.
And whether it is a ability or disability is really depending on the context. Like, I love that I'm sensitive in some cases, but it also makes it impossible for me to do things that other people can do. So, or if I'm not accommodated in that the way I would need, it becomes a disability because I will be in like full body pain for the next couple of days.
Yeah, that's a really good way of putting it. Yeah, what's a strength and what's an ability, a weakness is all dependent on the context you're in, isn't it? Yeah, that's right.
Maybe let's just jump to the question if synesthesia is connected to other neurodivergent conditions as well, like ADHD, epilepsy, migraines. Do we know anything about that?
One of the things that we don't know about that we really should is ADHD. There's been very little research on this, and obviously you might expect that given that there is a known link between autism and ADHD. You would imagine that synesthesia would have that. So I think that that is one of the unanswered questions that we still have dangling. In terms of other neurodivergent traits, migraine has been assessed a lot and it does not come out. There have been 3 or 4 studies that have looked at migraine. And again, this is interesting. So migraine is, again, linked to sensory sensitivity. So what do we make of that? Well, obviously, there might be multiple profiles of what it is to have sensory sensitivity underpinned by multiple mechanisms in the brain. So the migraine kind of sensory sensitivity is probably different to the synesthesia come autism sensory sensitivity, is my kind of guess on that. Other things related to, for example, mental health don't always come out. So depression doesn't come out. It's been looked at several times. It's not linked to synesthesia. Anxiety, some studies do find that, some don't. Again, anxiety is one of these things that we all know what it is, but actually it's got multiple different aspects. And when you break it down, it might be kind of more bodily feelings of anxiety. It might be more worry or rumination anxiety. So anxiety itself is a somewhat woolly concept that needs to be kind of broken down to understand how that's linked to synesthesia, if it is. Other neurodevelopmental conditions like schizophrenia, which are associated with unusual thought patterns, unusual experiences like hallucinations, they are not linked to synesthesia, where you might expect that they could be. We don't find this as more common in people with synesthesia. We don't find it in the families of people with synesthesia. So we find that synesthetes have people with autism in their family more than expected, but they don't have people with schizophrenia in their family more than expected. So I think I'm okay with the idea of labeling synesthesia as a neurodivergent trait, being part of a neurodivergent profile. But I think we need to not throw too many bags in that. I think it is quite a specific association between autism and perhaps a few other things. And it's certainly not the case that synesthesia is linked to widespread health problems in terms of either physical or mental health. And that is a very important message for people to know. But actually, it's also important scientifically because it suggests actually that the mechanisms are quite specific. It's not just a general vulnerability, to problems or health issues or however you want to kind of, or neurodiversity, you know, these sorts of.
The effect of synesthesia on mental health is something that I'm focusing on at the moment because I feel like there isn't really much out there that really looks at like the lived experience of what is it like to have synesthesia and how does it impact my mental health. But on the other hand, also, how does it help me cope with, you know, a panic attack, for example? Because if you have emotion synesthesia, for example, or if you have auditory visual synesthesia, you can watch the colors in your mind's eye and it might help you calm down from a panic attack or a very big feeling. So it goes both ways. Having synesthesia, if you know about it, yeah, your mental health can benefit from it, but it can also, like, tasting words or mirror touch definitely has its negative impacts on one's mental health. So I'm trying to really understand this by interviewing people. And it's so obvious that a lot of my interview guests and podcast guests and coaching clients are both autistic and synesthetes. A bunch of them are also ADHD and synesthetes, but most of the times they do have autism as well. So they're autistic ADHDers with synesthesia. So that's why for me the ADHD component is very interesting. But I think just don't have a clear answer for that yet.
I think that that's right. I think we don't necessarily have that answer. I mean, I think you raise a good point as to the particular types of synesthesia you have. You might be able to use that as either a kind of a coping strategy or something to focus on, or maybe even, you know, a focus of something that becomes a talent. So one of the things that we've looked at in our studies is people who visualize the calendar in their synesthesia. So a mental line of the days and the months. And we've trained people to be able to do what's called calendar calculation. So if I say, what day of the week is the 3rd of February, 1995, these kind of bizarre skills. People can train themselves to do this. But what we find is that people with the sequence space synesthesia pick up the skill faster than others. That they can use their timeline or that they, you know, they have a particular attentional focus that enables them to kind of learn and acquire these kinds of skills that, again, are some of the skills you find in autism. Things like perfect pitch, again, is something that is more common in people with synesthesia and is more common in people with autism. And again, we don't necessarily know why, but it's to do with the differences in the way that the senses develop early on, for example. Is it linked to particular types of synesthesia? I mean, to have perfect pitch, you need some element of music training. So your environment is going to be important. But people believe that there are still genetic dispositions. You know, some people, even with the right environment, are not going to ever develop perfect pitch.
Very interesting. Yeah. So far from my own experience. We spoke about like early childhood and how synesthesia and autism develops in different stages. You can get an autism diagnosis very, very young, but for synesthesia, it takes a little bit longer. Of course, for grapheme color synesthesia, you have to learn a script before you can like develop grapheme color synesthesia. At what point do we identify synesthetes most often?
Well, the answer really is kind of adulthood still. I think it depends on the parents, and you know, I think that's one of the what I see as being one of my kind of soft jobs as a researcher is just to spread the word. And it's what we're doing now. The more people understand about synesthesia, then they just ask their kids, here's a strange thing. Have you ever come across this? And some are just going to say, yeah, I have this. This isn't strange. This is perfectly normal. Of course, you know, the letter A is red and B is green or whatever it is. So that you can get these kind of informal diagnoses much earlier, you know, certainly at the start of school age, maybe earlier than this, we don't know for sure. really. And my guess is that the brains of synesthetes are different from very early on, you know, maybe from infancy,
certainly
in the preschool years. But whether synesthesia is there or whether it's there in a mature form, you know, with consistent associations, perhaps not. I think synesthesia probably matures and develops, but it doesn't develop out of thin air. It develops from having a different brain that is probably, you know, there from the very earliest stages, in the same way as, you know, there are biomarkers of, you know, autism from the very early stages, even if you haven't seen the behavioral traits yet coming out.
Totally. Thank you. Before we started recording, we spoke about like the connections of traits, and you asked me to name a couple. Do you want me to give you a couple of examples of how synesthesia and autism comes together in both my own experience and the experience of my coaching clients?
Yeah, it would be great to hear some examples that I can kind of reflect on. I don't know whether I'll have any insights, but basically this is how the research works, is that we're researching something that's very private and subjective. And if we don't talk to people and ask the right questions, we're going nowhere.
Yeah, definitely. You know, and it's also like just the other day, I made a post on Instagram about those possible ways they might work together. And a lot of people were just like, oh my God, I haven't realized that that makes so much sense. So I think we're just going to put it out on a podcast as well. So it's a slightly different audience. People can maybe, yeah, reflect on that. So I have both ticker type synesthesia, which is where you see subtitles to what other people say, what I say, and my own thoughts, just the words I think about. I see them written out, and because I have grapheme color synesthesia, I also see them out in different fonts and colors. But I also have echolalia, which is an autistic trait where you repeat words and sentences and lyrics of what people say, what you hear, what your own thoughts are. Very often my brain does something really annoying, which is I listen to a song. Mostly the last song I listen to will stick with me. Like even now that we're talking, the melody of the last song I listen to will go on in my head all the time. And then my brain would just pick a sentence, a random one, doesn't have any relation to the song, and will just repeat that sentence in the melody of the last song. And then I also see it written out. So that's one thing where I feel like it's super important to just acknowledge that this is something I have to either process or suppress in my day to day, that someone else doesn't have to.
Your intuition is that you have the echolalia because you have the ticker tape.
No, I think it's too unrelated. I think I have two unrelated things. Many synesthetes have ticker, or some synesthetes have ticker tape, and some autistic people have echolalia. But when you have autism and synesthesia, there will be, you can't avoid it. Some will overlap in a weird way. And I feel like this is one of the things where those two traits just shake hands and make my life a bit more difficult than it is for other people.
Yeah, okay, yeah, that also makes sense. I mean, obviously, without doing the statistics of a large sample, you don't know which of those options is true, but it does make sense, and other people have suggested similar things. So Simon Baron-Cohen has kind of studied the person with autism and synesthesia called Daniel Tammet, who reports these amazing kind of abilities with calculation and so on. The claim that's been made about him scientifically is the one that you're kind of suggesting, is that he coincidentally has synesthesia or autism. I think it's probably a little bit more than a coincidence, but actually the shape and form of both of these just come together and create a particular kind of pattern in him that is somewhat unique or somewhat idiosyncratic, but is very crucial to the way that he thinks and behaves.
Yeah, exactly. And I think this example that I just gave is like more on the negative side, just because like if I imagine I wouldn't have that, I feel like, wow, my brain would be so much calmer, which sounds really lovely. But then there are other overlap of traits. One of my interview guests, for example, has auditory visual synesthesia and alexithymia. So he has trouble reading the emotion of the other person he is talking to. But he realized that when listening to their voice, the saturation level of the sounds will change depending on whether the other person is angry or happy. So even though he can't tell by the statement they're making, let's say they say, I have news for you. He can't tell whether they are happy, sad, or angry news. But if he looks at the color, because of his auditory synesthesia, he can read that, which is a huge, like, positive impact on his communication.
Yeah, this makes sense. I mean, I always think that to some extent, synesthesia is what it is, but what you do with your synesthesia is kind of down to you. And you can use synesthesia as a tool. It doesn't always automatically become a tool. People often have to be a little bit creative or notice a certain thing. So in here, this is somebody who's noticing that the emotionality in people's voices have different colours. And in a way, this becomes something like a compensation strategy for, I guess, their autism of not being able to read people's inner thoughts in a kind of more conventional sense, and they relying on their synesthesia to compensate.
I find it so interesting, and that's just mainly what I do in my work, trying to help people figure out how they can improve their life quality by detecting both, like, just neurodivergent traits and how they work together, and realizing that not everybody does that and has that. And I guess also that it's okay that we're really, really tired at the end of the day. Like, I have a shitload to process every day.
Yeah, exactly. I think it comes down to what you were saying before about a lot of this is context dependent. So the synesthesia is what it is. Whether it's good or bad perhaps depends on how you're using it, when you're using it, and so on. And to some extent, that's out of your control because you can't, you know, you can't modify your synesthesia, but you might be able to attend to it, not attend to it, or process it in maybe some creative ways.
It's so unique. I love it. I feel like a detective helping people figure that out. I have one more question, and it relates more to my personal story. I'm not sure if a lot of, well, that's not true, actually. Okay, let me rephrase that. Over the last year, I very strangely developed something where if I get overstimulated sensory-wise over a couple of days or even just a day, I would end up in full body pain, like I mentioned before, which to me must be a result of, like, autistic overstimulation. But have you ever heard of people developing, like, actual joint skin and muscle pain from overstimulation?
I'll be honest and say no, but it doesn't mean that I don't believe you. It's not something I've come across before, but it's not something I've asked about as well. And people often avoid, scientists or researchers often avoid using the word pain because they think that people are using it metaphorically, actually sometimes they're not, that they really do imagine it as a physical in the body thing, you know.
There's real pain.
You could imagine something being painful in, like, a social context, and that's just a metaphor. But some people do really use this word, to imply such a thing. And I think that that's what you're saying. It's an embodied experience of being overwhelmed, not just a fatigue or something like this.
Yeah. Well, in the last days, and then due to my synesthesia, I can see the pain in colors. So the whole thing.
Wow.
Thank you for believing me. I'm gonna see a neurologist next week, and like all neurodivergent people, I feel like I'm just a bit scared of being not believed, especially when, you know, I called them and they asked what I have, and I said I have synesthesia as well, I'm not sure if it's relevant, and then she was like, oh, well, that sounds more like a psychiatry problem. Like, oh,
okay, right, yeah, well,
cool,
yeah, I'm not sure who you were speaking to, but they need to check the facts.
So I'm getting prepared to, like, you know, defend myself and have, like, the right arguments with me to make that appointment useful for myself. Before we wrap up, I have one last question that I wanted to ask earlier, but it slipped my mind. The prevalence of autism is 1% in the population, and synesthesia is estimated to be 4%. How reliable are those numbers, considering there's a whole generation of missed autistic women? So how reliable is the 1%? And then there's so many different forms of synesthesia. Is it 4%? Because I feel like a lot of synesthesia forms, like touch-related, sex-related, I don't know, they're just not part of the 4% because they can't be studied as well.
Yeah, I mean, the figures from autism, they do actually use a methodology that they would go and sample people in the population. So they're not just relying on people having gone to the doctors for a diagnosis.
Right.
You can sample, for example, 10,000 adolescents and screen them for autism and show that these kinds of figures right. do come out. So I don't think it's just a question of going through the system. Of course, even in that case, you are then applying a criteria that might have been derived as being more male appropriate than female appropriate. So mm-hmm. even with that rigorous scientific approach, it still comes down to the question of how you are going to define and diagnose it, even if you mm-hmm. are screening women as well as men. That's not to kind of dismiss it. I think it mm-hmm. then becomes circular as to how you want to define it. So I think that it is about right, but it does depend on how you choose to define it and how you choose to define the cutoff for severity. Because obviously there'll be a lot of people with autistic traits who are not diagnosed with autism and perhaps need some label of neurodiversity, need some understanding from their family and friends. I don't know, but they're not meeting that cutoff. So there are these kinds of issues around that. But basically, these figures are relatively reliable, given these kinds of constraints. For synesthesia, it really does depend on the types you're talking about. So for things like sequence-based synesthesia, I think that the figure's much higher. I think it's like 7-8% of the population have sequence-based synesthesia. Mirror touch is about 1% of the population, but things like mirror pain, so seeing somebody in pain mm-hmm. and then feeling yourself, this is common. It's maybe like 20% of the population. I mean, running this problem, maybe they're being metaphorical, but I don't think they are. We've tried to push on this, and then people don't like it because they say, well, if it's that common, it's not synesthesia, it's just normal. But it's, if it's 20%, it's kind of normal, but it's still rare. It's I don't know what the language is at this point. It's neurodivergent or whatever, but it's certainly a rare trait to have, even if something goes to 20%. So it's hard to say. One of the things that we do actually find, to bring the conversation back to autism, is that the more types of synesthesia you have, the further along the autism spectrum you are. So if you've got one or two types, you may show some autism traits. You're maybe more likely to get a diagnosis. If you've got five or six types, it kind of the risk goes much higher. So it seems to be that being more extreme on the synesthesia spectrum, or having lots of types of synesthesia, is mm-hmm. more strongly related to autism. So I think some of these common types, if you just have one of these things, you're probably not going to be far up the autism spectrum on average. And the point at which you've got lots of these types of synesthesia, it tends to go a little bit more hand in hand with autism. So it does depend on how you're defining and counting synesthesia, and how you're defining and setting your threshold for autism. All of these things they have to do.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's just a relief for me, but I think probably it's obvious, but still, that they don't look at like the NHS diagnosis system and be like, oh, 1% has autism, but you actually approach in a random population and you screen them. That makes a lot more sense.
Yeah.
Makes the number a lot more reliable. Great. I think that's all we have time for today. Thank you so, so much. I really enjoyed our second conversation. Thank you so much for giving all your insight. And I guess see you at the Oxford conference, Synesthesia conference in May.
Yeah, I will be there in May and look forward to seeing you in person and some of your listeners.
So excited for that. Thank you so, so much.
You're welcome. Thank you for such interesting questions.
Thank you. Take care. Bye.
It's me again. Thank you so, so much for listening. If you stayed until the very end, thank you so much for supporting the podcast. If you have a second, please give it a rating on the podcast platform you are listening to. This would help me out a ton. Okay, take care and see you for the next episode. Bye.
You've been listening to Let's Talk Synesthesia. There'll be a new episode of Series 1 every Tuesday. If you enjoyed listening, you can like, follow, and share. Details about the podcast and how to connect with today's speakers can be found in the show notes. The executive producer was Micah Pricing, with music by Corinne Anderson, and the podcast was supported by a couple more neurodivergent people in the background. See you next week.